And now, your ChillPack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hooray, I love that one. That's the Kenny B song.
By the B Film Extra.
That's awesome. Okay. So, hey, everybody, here we are. Another episode of your ChillPack Hollywood Hour.
From the Eastern Columbia building?
Like they said.
High atop the historic core. Well, they left it generic, which I like.
So that we can go to...
It gives us room. Yeah, because we have moved before.
We have. So technically, we can go up the street or something.
No.
But we have to keep it within the downtown.
An historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Right.
That's good. So
that's
we
good.
Could. We could squat anywhere and do this show.
We got a 12-block radius to figure that out. Fantastic.
So who are you?
I'm Dean Haglund, of course. You can't get that wrong.
And I'm Phil Lernis.
Yes, you can get that wrong.
And we are collectively your friends in podcasting. And we are back from Sacramento.
Oh, my gosh.
California.
Good times we had there.
That was fun.
It was kind of really fun, actually.
I mean, I thought at first... We were kind of riding the rail. It could have gone either direction.
Yeah.
And having left at 2:00 in the morning to drive to Sacramento, when that sun came up and suddenly
oh
I was hit with this headache all over my face, I thought, okay, this could be altogether wrong.
And then stopping at an IHOP and eating whatever I had.
And yet, it all somehow just worked.
I know. Good day, Sacramento. What a fun show that was.
We had so much fun.
Yes.
And then we had a great lunch with Robert, our host from Movies on a Big Screen, and his friend Trina, who was kind enough to give us a place to crash for a couple of hours.
Totally. And then I had barbecue ribs with J.H. Williams III, famed comic book artist and writer of the new Batwoman series. And holy smokes, how great that was.
I thought of him and you this week when I saw that the original check that Detective Comics paid... Is it Siegel and Shuster who
Siegel
created
and Shuster. Yeah, yeah.
Superman?
Right.
The original check for the rights, buying the rights
to
in
Superman.
Perpetuity to Superman for $130, that check sold in an online auction this week for $160,000.
See, now that's pretty cool.
You think it's cool, but I suddenly was plunged even more into depression because realized that once that cash got checked, the canceled check became the property of Detective Comics.
Oh.
Because in the old days, certainly,
right.
When everything was hard copy checks, you would always at the end of the month get your checks
back.
That had been cashed.
Didn't they do that then?
Or deposited. So they did that then, but that means it went to DC.
Oh.
So it was even more money that the... And anyway, what it turned out to be was that someone in the accounting department during the years had just kind of lifted that check and in an online auction made money off it. So it did not go to the family.
Well, but in the 1990s when it realized that, in fact... I think it was Shuster, or maybe it was Siegel, but he was actually a delivery guy in New York, and he was delivering to DC and seeing the giant Superman thing that he not had collected a cent on. In the 90s, they finally shamed DC into paying out a huge...
He died around 92, I think.
Yeah, so it was in that time that the family then started receiving royalties. But it was a huge 50-year gap of not seeing a cent as that thing took off. You know, it's got to be pretty hard too when Christopher Reeve movie came out and it was just like, and the TV series in the 50s, that's karma.
So depressing.
That's karma on DC's part. I don't want to talk about it. But anyway, now that's all changed and artists like Jim Williams does very well with his Batwoman series.
He had such nice things to say about Our Truth Is Out There in his blog.
I know, his blog. I meant to email him and say thank you for those lovely comments. He seemed to really enjoy it, and everyone did that came. I thought that was a really good screening.
How could people not enjoy it?
Well, I often ask that.
Two people walked out. We always have two people walk out. It doesn't matter how big or how small the audience size is. There will always be two people. And in fact, it was really funny because in Salem, Oregon, uh-huh. at one of the Salem Film Festival screenings, I actually let the audience know afterwards that those I showed a piece of paper that I had written. As soon as I finished introing the film, I wrote down who the two people would be. And I showed it. It was a great magic. It was a magic trick. I made two audience members disappear.
What? How is that possible?
It's always the way, which lets you know that we're doing something right.
Yes, that you got to offend somebody.
You know, there's got to be that and...
some controversy. Some...
Yeah.
I don't know what to...
It is amazing, isn't it, that the idea that listening to each other and learning from each other
is
and not
offensive.
Judging each other... Nothing could be more offensive.
That's right.
But then again, look at us historically. Nothing gets you nailed to two pieces of wood faster than saying you should love your fellow human being.
That's right.
Right.
So true. Oh, well, there you go. So anyway, that you was know, Sacramento.
And the United Kingdom has several chances to enjoy The Truth Is Out There coming up next week.
That's right. You'll be there.
May 1st at Goldsmiths College, University of London in the afternoon. A screening of the film. I'll be there on May 2nd at the University of Lincoln.
Yes.
And on May 3rd in Birmingham as a screening for the Birmingham UFO group.
Well,
so three opportunities next week in
that.
The UK.
Wow.
To see The Truth Is Out There. People can find out how to see The Truth Is Out There and how to order a copy or download the film.
Every sorts of things.
At truth-is-out-there.com.
So easy.
Truth-is-out-there.com.
It's The Truth Is Out There with dashes in between it.
Now, this is our last new show for a couple of weeks, then our live show, not new show.
No, right.
We've got two new shows planned.
Right.
It's the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour equivalent of the Tupac hologram.
Oh, my God. And then do you see the Coachella all hologram lineup next year? It's Mozart. Like everybody who's been in a band. Who's
Did you say the
up.
Clash? Yeah. Yeah, I like if it's hologram of people who are alive. That would even be better.
That's even funnier.
Wait, wasn't there a Broadway show where Olivier actually appeared as a hologram each and every
No, that was
episode?
The Wooster Group. They did filmed parts of a movie of Hamlet that didn't get made. Not Olivier, but it was Richard Burton.
But who was... I thought Starlight Express used holograms or something like that. We'll have to look into
that. We have to look into that.
I'm sure there is someone already, and I'm talking to you, Pliskin. There is someone already typing us and posting the answer.
Posted. That's right.
Even before the show has been put up.
How is he hearing us?
By the way, what a good segue. Speaking of Mr. Pliskin.
Yes.
He introduced us to this concept of paranoia.
Yes.
Last week.
I was fascinated by that.
Even though this is a concept that's been going back decades now.
Decades.
And it is been called the antidote to paranoia.
Right.
It's, although as we discussed, it's kind of an interesting mirror image to paranoia.
Right.
It's the concept, basically...
The belief that everyone...
That forces are conspiring all around you... To make things work out on your behalf.
Right.
Exactly the opposite of a paranoid conspiracy
right.
theory.
Here the Illuminati is trying to make your life awesome.
Or forces are.
Forces are,
and,
yes.
And as I understood it, it was in fact people. There is a more broad sense of it that it is just forces. And this is what we'll discuss a little bit today.
Mm.
But the first thing is it gets back to this... idea of this word conspiracy, which of course automatically is thought of as
evil.
Negative
yes.
and evil. And in fact, as we've tried to say from time to time, there's nothing about the word itself that implies
evilness,
negative energy in
right.
any way.
It's from the Latin con and spire, to breathe together.
Right.
Right.
As opposed to inspire, to breathe into.
Right.
You know, to breathe your life into something is to inspire it.
To conspire.
To breathe together.
Right.
And on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour for almost 5 years now, we have, I like to think, conspired to inspire.
Ah, look at us. Why isn't that on a t-shirt?
We got a few t-shirts left to sell, then we'll...
That's our next one.
But we did sell one.
We did.
In Sacramento.
That's right. Good thing we brought them.
What an attractive crowd it was in Sacramento, too.
I know.
I mean, I say this almost like it's like I'm surprised by that, but I certainly don't spend a lot of time in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
And This was an audience that was very easy on the eyes. Collectively, just a lovely, lovely audience.
Now, wait a sec. Are you saying that other audiences we've been to have been a little harsh on the eyes?
No.
Okay. No. Just seeing what the...
Only when it's sparsely populated. Only a sparsely populated crowd is hard on the eyes.
I see.
For me.
That's right.
No, it was just a beautiful gathering of people, though.
Yes,
I mean the energy was radiant and
fun
and
we thank everyone who came to that.
Now, certainly the forces conspired to make it a fun
right.
Night
see, there you go
for us.
So that's your pronoia talking.
And what a great idea! Oh, I'm jumping all around here, but Robert, who runs movies on a big screen, what a cool thing for Sacramento to have. I mean, it is a never-ending film festival, basically.
Yeah,
once a week. Movies on a big screen, chance to see a film on the big screen that you wouldn't otherwise get a chance to in that format. And again, there is something so special about that. And he charges like $5 a head. So it's such a great opportunity in a great venue to see something that, to take a chance on seeing something different.
That's all. How hard is that?
So again, we thank you, Robert, for conspiring to make things work out
with your
our benefit and to the benefit of our film and to the benefit of everyone in the audience.
Again, that's your pronoia speaking.
Katrine Salyers tweeted me about Rob Brezhne, who I knew immediately. She said, are you familiar with this? Rob Brezhne is one of the most popular, maybe the most popular, I don't know, syndicated horoscope writers.
I did not know that.
Since, I think it's 98, he's been writing the Free Will Astrology column.
Okay.
And it, I don't anymore, but it was such a good read. I've never been somebody who particularly has paid much attention to astrology or, you know, horoscopes or these things. But his column, his weekly column, was so wonderfully written. And again, so inspiring.
Yes.
That it just was, it was a great read.
Wow.
And so Rob Brezhne, the author of the Free Will Astrology column, wrote a book a few years back called Pronoia is the Antidote to Paranoia.
Ah, the antidote.
And so there's a book about it that's supposed to be very good.
Right, written by
why
your
does my voice
guy?
Keep cracking? I promised myself I wasn't going to cry. But there is a book, my favorite guy. Now he's my favorite guy. Anyway, he wrote a book, Pronoia is the Antidote to Paranoia, and I might avail myself of reading that. However, as you know, I have a rule that I can't add anything more to my pile of books to read until I finish this pile of books. Books can be given me. Hint.
Oh my God.
But I have such a stack of books to be read, which is what motivated my New Year's
resolution to go 25
to read at least
pages.
25 pages a day.
How's that going for you?
Should we talk about what we're reading?
Sure.
I finished the John Adams.
You finally finished that. John Adams, period.
Period.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, I really had to fight the urge to just start it over again.
No, really?
So extraordinary was this read.
Wow.
That I wanted to start again. And instead, I managed to put it aside, and I began a new book. I began Shadowland. I hope I wrote the author down. I didn't write the author down. It's in my bag, though. But Shadowland, by a longtime reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Uh-huh.
And it was published in 1978, and it was a detailed investigation into the mysterious life of Francis Farmer.
Oh, yeah.
And I do not know, made famous for later generations in the Academy Award-winning film starring Jessica Lange in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I do not know whether that film was based on this book. I can't see how it wasn't. It certainly had to, again, have been in part inspired by this book coming out, revealing
many
of the details about this mysterious life. But truly, it's not just the going crazy and what she went through in the late 40s and the torture that she endured as an unnamed mental patient.
Yes.
In these institutions.
And being given a lobotomy through the...
But the mysteries of her life prior to that are incredible.
Really?
I mean, it really is an amazing story. And you can tell that it's written by a reporter. His prose style is very rapid. It's very
succinct.
Succinct to the point. This is what people say. This is what the records show. Boom, on to the next chapter.
Wait a second. And wasn't she just a child in Seattle, went to acting school, and then went to Hollywood and auditioned?
No.
That's not the story?
First of all, she was born to two people who were well past the age to bear children.
What?
To have children, even though she looked identical to her father. So there can be no doubt of that relationship. But, I mean, that's mystery one. The parents themselves are really interesting figures and fairly important historic figures. And the era in which she grew up was a very important, you know, it's the foundation of the labor movement in the United States in Seattle right then. But so many interesting, controversial parts of our history surround her birth and her early upbringing. Being an nationally award-winning writer at age 10.
What?
Where within a matter of weeks, she went from being local student wins national award for writing to being the Antichrist for what she wrote.
Oh my gosh.
Because that award-winning story was called The Death of God at age 10.
Holy smokes.
The Hollywood career and all of this is the least of it. And anyway, I'll talk about it more once I've had a chance to
really get into
reading the book.
Fantastic.
So in a couple of weeks, though, as we said, this is our last live show for a couple of weeks because I'm hitting the road for the UK and for France, Northern France.
I'm going to be in Texas at a painting workshop.
Aren't you going to be in Pennsylvania beforehand?
Yeah. That's this weekend. I'm going to.
So I go to the UK and Northern France. You go to Pennsylvania and Texas.
See how that works? That's fantastic.
I do not want to switch places with you.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, you know, I should tell you, this is an on-air production meeting, but I may be going to do the Fringe Festival again this year in Scotland.
Well, hello.
No, I got an offer for a play, and they're just now coordinating to see if all our timing can work out. A little play on the old Fringe stage. And
there's plenty we could shoot for Truth Is Out There, too, in Scotland.
I am telling you.
Just so what are you reading?
Well, I'm still reading the homeborn journey of all the American expatriates who went to Paris, France in the 1830s by Mr. David McCullough. And
really? That's David McCullough?
I think it's
because that's who wrote John Adams.
No, that can't be the same guy. And McCullough?
You need to check this out.
Okay, you keep talking.
I'm also reading, and I'll be bringing with me to the UK, of course, my Wallace Stevens collection of poetry. And one play, indeed. And I was really touched by something that John Adams stressed to his son, John Quincy, and would remind him again during John Quincy's upbringing, which was the importance of always having a book of poetry with you at all times. Because you will never be alone so long as you have a poet in your back pocket.
I love that.
I will be traveling with Wallace Stevens.
David McCullough, The Greater Journey,
Americans in Paris.
There's a picture of him on the back.
And he is the author of John Adams, period. And so now this is another movie. Another book that I need to... So, in other words, again, if something is given to me to read, I can't say no. I'm not allowed to say no, but I can't pick it and add it to my...
Well, I'm halfway through, so...
Such a wonderful writer, isn't he?
I really enjoy the writing style.
So, again, this will be our last live show for 2 weeks, but it doesn't mean you won't get brand new installments of your Chill Pack Hollywood
Hour. We think ahead here on the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Next week, two fantastic guests on one show.
Amazingly.
And then the week after that...
Our fifth anniversary. 5 years.
And this year we really did make the anniversary show, a look back at 5 years.
In fondness.
And of course, we can't but help to have an on-air production meeting looking ahead for the next 5 years.
That's right. That always happens. Much like we have here on-air production meetings, almost on a weekly basis. No?
Should we talk about the live event of the week?
Yeah, let's do that, because I got one, too. I went to a live event separate from your live event, unless you're thinking of the live event.
I'm trying to give enough of a pause so we can cut in live event of the week.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
I see.
Tonight, we're not going to get a chance to talk about this for a few weeks,
right.
and it's a one-time-only thing, but we are seeing... Are you going?
Well, I didn't make my reservation yet.
Good work.
So
I am seeing our friend James Kerwin's triggers.
Yeah, I'm going to go
at the blank theater.
Hang out in front door, and hopefully there's a spare seat. Or
you're going to play the X-Files card.
I'm totally jabbing.
Do you remember me? Perhaps you remember me. I used to have long hair.
I'm going to bring my glasses.
No. And I would like to talk about perhaps a future live event I hope we will be able to see, mm-hmm. because it's from one of the listeners of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I always love when people let us know about their creative pursuits. Stuff. And in fact, I wished Enrique Acosta had let me know about this when this was playing at the Lyric Theater on Hyperion, a space right around the corner from me. Yeah. I would have come and seen this show.
What was this show?
And it's called Spider Baby the Musical. And you can find out about it at spiderbabythemusical.com. And I hope our listeners will visit spiderbabythemusical.com. There's videos of the show in the different cities where it's been performed and a trailer for it. Because Enrique hopes to bring this horror rock musical adaptation of Spider Baby to San Diego Comic-Con this summer.
Wow.
So he asked me to take a look at the website and to mention the show on, or to mention his show here on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
So it's a live musical event?
It's a live musical stage adaptation.
Right, of a movie called Spider
Baby. No, of Spider Baby, which is, I think, based on a real life murder case, isn't it?
Oh, really? I don't know.
And it's toured for 2 years.
Wow.
And so
big names.
He's working to get it
over to
staged in San Diego Comic-Con.
There's some big some big stage productions that go through San Diego Comic-Con. They did Lord of the Rings musical about 5 or 10 years ago. Not 10. Let's say 7 years ago that LA Improv did. And it was very successful that they went around flyering and everybody came to a Lord of the Rings musical. So I wish the same luck for Spider Baby.
So we each have a live event that we did see. What is yours?
My niece won gold medal at the in Disneyland, no less, where they had the high school, she's in the eighth grade. So it was a choir singing contest with the Heritage Forum Foundation, I believe. And they were flown from Vancouver, some 110 kids with chaperones and everything, and it was a full musical number, a medley of 1950s rock songs with full choreography, mind you, and outfits. I don't know how
they performed this at Disneyland.
I saw it at Fullerton, the Lewis A. Plummer Auditorium at the Fullerton High School, but then their final night was at Disneyland. And they won the gold medal. So my niece is a gold medal choir singing.
I met this niece.
You did.
Too. She's a little spark plug.
Little spark plug, that one. And, and she's been taking a lot of dance and ballet, and so it's really paying off.
She's great. Yes. So it won't be long before she's coming down to ask Uncle Dean to hook up the, introductions, get her an agent, which, of course, then actually you need to ask her to do the same thing for you.
I know. I said, here's an agent I fired. Why didn't you talk to that person? No, that'd be bad.
Well, I'm both thrilled that that was your live event and disappointed that that was your live event. What? So you can be both happy and sad for me in this moment.
I am. What's the disappointment?
Because my live event was based on more or less you forcing me to see it, thinking that you were going to see it.
What?
Oh. I saw last night the closing night of Waiting for Godot at the Mark Taper Forum.
Is it already? It is April. Oh,
you told me it was closing weekend in the drive to Sacramento. And you raved totally about this. You told me about Barry McGovern and Alan Mendel, the leads in this.
I know.
And Waiting for Godot, right? Isn't that it?
Godot. Yes.
It's mispronounced within the show as Godot by Pozzo, but it's Godot.
Right. Yeah.
And the Samuel Beckett masterpiece. And so anyway, so I saw this.
Oh, you did?
And you had told me about Alan Mandel and Barry McGovern, whose work I knew from other things. But what I did not know was that these two actors are
lifetime scholars of Beckett.
Of Beckett. They have been each performing Beckett's works
and
for decades.
And
they
met
spend much of their career doing Beckett works. And
this is their signature piece. This is what they...
This was the first time Alan Mandel played Estragon.
Oh, yeah.
Because up until now, 84-year-old Alan Mandel had been playing Lucky. And for those of you who do not know the play, the role of Lucky is could not be more physically demanding.
Film physically demanding. You have no. You have
there
one.
There has never been. I don't. I cannot think of a part in a play that is more physically demanding.
You are chained up. You are in a garbage can in some
but, not in a garbage can. That I've you're seen thinking in Crap's last tape. I think. Oh, yeah. But okay. Or Endgame. But you play a slave. You carry baggage. You. I mean, that both in terms of the physical strength and the endurance, but also the limberness and dexterity that is required.
Yeah.
As you are being yanked backwards onto your back by a noose around your neck.
Yeah, over and over again. And then you have a gibberish monologue that's some 3 to 5 pages long.
Oh, that, this monologue is one of the great monologues in so, theater.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And so they are extraordinary. They are absolute treasures. I mean, Alan Mandel is, I mean, he's exactly that. He's a treasure. And in this role of Estragon, I can't imagine picturing anyone else, except ironically, Lily Holloman. I think she could play this old man. Barry McGovern as Vladimir, I had to resist going up to him afterwards to tell him what I wanted to say, which is, I want to be you when I grow up. I really did. Like, really? I wanted to be him in that role.
You
want to
be Vladimir? That's like the most...
Him, how he embodies that role and his timing.
Yes.
James Cromwell, the great Oscar-nominated actor, James Cromwell played Pozzo.
Yes.
And playing Lucky... A man that no one outside of Los Angeles probably knows because he's done very little television and film work, but he is probably the best
theater
stage actor in Los Angeles. Hugo Armstrong played Lucky. Lily acted with him in his Ovation Award-winning role in Bleed Rail.
Ah.
She was nominated for an Ovation Award for that as well. And so I've been aware of Hugo's work and seen him in several plays. And he got an astounding... ovation.
Really?
Last night in this. I mean, it really was so touching because you got the sense that for all the great achievements he's had on stage, this might be the thing that really catapults him to that next level.
Really?
And it was so sweet seeing James Cromwell meet Hugo's mother backstage afterwards.
Uh-huh.
Because... James Cromwell just kept saying to her what a good job she had done because he is the sweetest boy. He is the sweet. Your son is the sweetest boy. And, of course, he had just played this fiery, ferocious role on stage. And he truly is just about the sweetest man you will ever
meet.
Anyway, so it was a great production of Waiting for Godot.
Yeah.
And, of course, I am... a huge fan of The Absurdists.
Of course.
I mean, I used to, as back when I was before I was even a teenager, uh-huh. I loved reading plays, and I still have all of Beckett's work in my library, but I loved The Absurdists. I was drawn as a child to the works of Beckett and Pinter and Ionesco and you know, Zoo Story,
Albee,
and, of course, Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Yep.
And it's fascinating because I... understood them as a child in a way that I would no longer understand them by the time I got to college.
Wow.
And now I'm at the age where I feel I understand them again. And it was so fascinating to be sitting in a row with someone who quite clearly considered himself a scholar of absurdist cinema and was explaining everything to his date. And I felt such a relief to be past the point where I have to intellectually analyze any of these things, because I almost feel like an intellectual analysis of absurdist work is in itself absurd and misses the point.
And misses the point itself, yeah. That you lose the emotional,
because, you know, I think people can get driven to want to analyze it because of what they consider the abstract nature of these works. But the truth is, they are not abstract. They're not abstract in the sense of surrealism or some other things. Yes, there are symbols in them, but everything is a symbol.
Yeah.
The absurdist work is so blissful to me, and one of the reasons why I think children, young people can really enjoy it, is because the stripping away of narrative, it's really marked by the minimal narrative necessary to have a play.
To have two people
to recognize that a play is going on.
Right.
To me, what is abstract is when you don't even recognize it as a play.
Right.
The Dadaists,
exactly.
For example. so you strip it away. So it's the bare minimum of a narrative. And you strip all that narrative away so that the actors, and therefore the audience, are free to find moments of truth.
Yes.
In these
again
plays.
And again and again.
And in real life, that's all we get,
that's
are
all
moments
get.
Of truth. For no matter how much we spend seeking, it's only moments of truth that you get. And you get them when you acknowledge, oh, by the way, the absurd dreamlike nature of real life.
Absolutely, because our narrative is only visible to us after it's happened. You can only look back on your life and see the narrative. You can't see the narrative as it's happening because you can never know the future.
But we certainly can be stuck in that narrative.
Thinking.
Much like Estragon and Vladimir.
Yes.
And the pain that gets caught from being stuck in it, as opposed to starting to recognize the patterns
that they
of
are
things,
things
that you only get to do in those absurd dreamlike moments of your life.
Ah,
it's fantastic. It's fantastic stuff.
I'm shocked.
And a story that you would love. I mean, this is, we talk about live events of the week, and one of the things that you love live events is because of that thing that has never happened before and never happen again. And sometimes you know you're seeing something like this. I had read, because you turned me on to this production so much, I'd been reading about this play and this production, and I was loving reading about how, I think it first premiered in 1953, the
yes.
play in Paris, and it led to fist fights almost every night.
Oh, yeah.
In
yeah,
the
people
theater.
Could not. And then this is the one rare time that all theater critics wrote a letter of apology to the playwright. After they criticized, they said, this is the most ridiculous thing they've seen. Then understood it, then wrote an apology to Samuel Beckett, who was an Irish playwright.
But so the unnerving aspect of this material, and it is unnerving.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to the theater hoping to be, I want to be entertained,
right.
I want to be diverted, you know, it's still, despite all of its
comedy.
Landmark status and the general acceptance that this is a masterpiece and that it's funny, it's unnerving still to watch this play, and it's painful at
yeah.
times. It's a huge amount of fun. There are moments, though, of genuine
pain. There better be.
And so what's fascinating to have read about all the fights that would break out because the audience members didn't know what to do with the energy. They didn't know what to do with what they were feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
They were getting fights with each other, never mind attacking the people performing the play. Fight broke out in the Mark Taper forum.
What?
Last night.
No.
Over someone's cell phone at the beginning of Act Two. This thing went from an exchange of words, it escalated so out of proportion so quickly.
Really?
And what was brilliant about it was you get this sense that the energy in the house is fueling
right.
the intensity of this disagreement. They get pulled outside.
Where are they?
Into the corridor.
Are they in the orchestra or up in the balcony?
Well, there isn't a balcony. There's, but they are in the upper section,
okay.
in the center, looking down.
Yeah.
And but near the back of the house.
Okay.
So initially, of course, the disagreement couldn't be heard by everyone. But what could be heard by everyone was those people all around them shushing them. Right? One or two people having a disagreement can ruin the entire
area
play because
yeah.
it spreads quickly. That energy spreads. And so anyway, they were then pulled out. Their wives were pulled out into the corridors outside where it really escalated and got so loud that everyone could hear what was being
yelled
expressed.
At. Wow.
What I love is at that moment, when everyone heard this, the next scripted line in the play, I kid you not, scripted line was Vladimir's expression, they all speak at once.
No way.
And so it was extraordinary because I know for a fact that that line penned by Beckett decades ago never received the overwhelming laughter or ovation that that line received last night when its timing was
perfect.
Perfect.
And that was, okay, so were the actors waiting for this fight to end before they said that line, or were they just continuing as if?
Well, they're talking about how they hear the voices of the dead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they're hearing that
but
fight.
Much of those lines could not be heard of the fight.
Right, so they didn't stop while this fight went on and just observed, because there's ways of doing that play. I've seen this play, I've seen back in college, I think a three-hour production where the timing was put huge long gaps where the two just sat and looked at the audience and then said, you know, another beat. So each beat was parentheses with huge long pauses that just made it super uncomfortable and somewhat dull. But I'm saying that that play has potential of just sitting and waiting for that fight to finish itself.
Yeah.
And then you can carry on.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think maybe they did. But again, Barry McGovern, I want to be him when I grow up, because his timing was such that, you know, he played the audience like, you know, a harp from hell.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Did you see any movies this week?
Hello.
Last week we discussed Hunger Games.
Yes.
My misgivings over what it says about us culturally, that it is embraced to such a great degree. Some interesting feedback from our discussion first of all, you know, my excitement over who might be set to be the director of the next installment of it has been diminished somewhat by the announcement that it's Francis Lawrence, who directed I Am Legend, which had some good things going for it.
Sort of.
Had an act that was good. The first act,
was good. Way to shut down New York.
He also directed Constantine, least favorite comic book adaptation of all time, because it was my favorite comic book.
Hellraiser was a good comic book. But Constantine, not so.
And he directed Water for Elephants recently, the period piece with Robert Pattinson.
Right, and
Reese Witherspoon.
Reese Witherspoon.
So I don't need to see the sequel. That's the good news. I had talked about, first of all, how had any dystopian film, you know, view of the future ever been so embraced popularly as this film is.
Right.
And Plissken, again, right on it, The Matrix. Indeed.
Yes,
The Matrix is
dystopian.
You know, because I was thinking about other ones, you know, even like Firefly. Why didn't that get the pop culture embrace that I thought that it deserved?
Yeah.
To me, you know, it's the nightmare version of Star Trek, and people didn't want that maybe.
No.
But he is right. The
Matrix was pretty popular. But I think...
And there's cult following of Firefly. There's cult following of Battlestar Galactica. It's not that these things aren't popular, but it's a cult popularity, much like the cult popularity of Blade Runner or of other really affecting and effective dystopian views.
Right.
For something to be embraced as a cultural dream by the collective means to me that we are there.
Yes.
We're already there. It is already holding a mirror up to what we know is true.
And resonating.
And so he is right that it's happened before with The Matrix, but it doesn't alter my point of view on this, because I think the reason The Matrix resonated so much with its theme of needing to wake up to The Matrix is where consciousness has been at for the last 10, 12 years.
Absolutely. As I always said, The Matrix is a metaphor for Zen Buddhist nirvana awakening. Finally, at the final end, he can see through the reality and just see code, and that's why the bullets stop in midair, that nothing in the three-dimensional reality can affect him, because he knows it to be an artificial construct, which is very much what Buddhism teaches in their thing, that this is all reality is an illusion, and that you work towards having that illusion not affect you, but go beyond that. So I could see Matrix being that, but Hunger Games does not have any metaphor.
Well, and now, so let's get back to this idea of child exploitation.
Right.
And, you know, I wasn't criticizing the movie for its premise.
Right.
That would be a different discussion. What I was unnerved by is, again, the popular embrace of this dystopian future where children are forced to fight to the death as entertainment for the masses. For that to be embraced so wholeheartedly meant that we are there because we are paying our money to watch children forced to fight to the death for our entertainment. We are there.
Theoretically,
we have seen the future and we are it.
Yeah. Theoretically, you could strip away the first 15 minutes where it sets up that this television reality show exists and just watch it as the show itself, is what you're saying.
Now Pliskin pointed out, though, that teenagers exploited, you know, death and the violence against and the death of teenagers has long been part of popular entertainment, like mm-hmm. horror films.
Like
Cabin
right.
in the Woods is
Cabin
based on
Woods.
This.
That's
however,
right.
horror never, ever has been embraced in such a
popular culture,
in such a
large
popular way,
yes,
as a collective statement of where we are. Mm. Instead, it always has reflected kind of the popular nightmare, you know, and I think it does express the reality of the exploitation. It has historically always shown the reality of the exploitation that's going on.
Right.
But the exploitation we don't want to necessarily acknowledge is going on.
Okay. I'm following you so far.
I mean, we've talked about, we've always exploited children.
Right.
We've exploited them in entertainment.
Industrial Revolution?
Child actors.
Child
you
actors.
Know what goes through
the, oh, yeah. Jackie Cooper.
Child labor gets exploited.
Still to this day.
We've got the Society of Pageants.
Mm-hmm. Toddlers and Tiaras.
You know, that's my thing again, every time you have a movie and you allow a child to get kidnapped or to be in jeopardy because that's the easiest way to manipulate the audience's emotions,
yep.
that's exploiting children.
Absolutely.
So we have that culture.
The smoking babies of Indonesia.
And so, again, horror kind of shows us really the dark side of the culture in which we live.
Right.
For Hunger Games to, again, achieve this sort of
level of
success, it means we all acknowledge we are there and we're okay with it.
Or, well, see, this is the thing. Are we okay with it? I don't know. If we go to a movie because we're okay with it, we go to a movie because it's there and we're wrestling or exploring those ideas. But I don't necessarily
well,
walk
okay.
into...
Okay, certainly we are aware of it.
Yes.
It has been moved out of our unconscious and it is in our conscious. You're right, because I don't know these books, The Hunger Games, to the point to say that, you know, perhaps a revolution is led
right.
in these books that transforms culture and the children shall lead that revolution.
Right. Sounds
right?
great.
So this is just the first chapter in that, which again is why I'm saying I'm not making a critique of the movie or the story in this conversation. I'm having a critique of what it says about us and
right.
a critique of our culture
yes.
that we have come to this point.
Right. But I, and again, it's not that we're okay with it. It's that we are now wrestling.
Aware of it.
Wrestling the awareness.
And we ought to be, because again, we are that future.
We are that future. We are there. And what does that mean? So.
And so back to the original thing that inspired it, that saddens me.
Well, but I don't know. I mean, it saddens me if we're okay with it.
But I would like to see an end. I would like to see a revolution led by the children, where children are allowed to be children, where children are not put in pageants, where we do not allow 10-year-old gymnasts, where we do not
have
children
Indonesia,
making
yes.
my Nikes.
all of that.
You know.
Yes, where kids are allowed to be kids.
So perhaps this metaphor will play out and resonate in such a way that starts to plant some seeds.
And be the revolution that
you're right. Because, yes. indeed, all of this is conspiring to the benefit of children. Right.
It's pro-noia. Once again.
So listen up, child exploiters. Pro-noia will destroy you.
Yeah, that's right.
I saw Bully. I finally saw
you did that.
Bully. You know,
yeah.
I could not do it after seeing Hunger Games.
Right.
So I plunged headlong into the violence and persecution that an inordinate number of children face every day
mm-hmm.
in the name of going to school.
Right.
And what a heart-wrenching film this is. It's not for the faint-hearted. How dare the MPAA ever have given this film an R rating?
Really?
The scenes that you see on these buses that gave it its R rating, it is appalling. It is shameful that they would give this an R rating and not allow the widest audience possible to see this. That said, good for them for having really the balls to set a dangerous precedent,
right,
of changing the rating and of changing the rating and allowing them to immediately reissue the film in as wide a distribution as possible with the new rating.
Right.
That especially was a dangerous precedent they're setting, because that had gone against their rules. Rules that they always maintained were set up to protect viewers.
Right.
And now they waived those so that this film, which is important, could be seen by as many people as soon as possible, because quite frankly, every day that goes by, more and more kids are being bullied.
And so is there a solution in this movie?
There are solutions that are offered,
right,
of course.
Any of them
it
practical?
It is hopeful in that way, yes.
No good.
The question that I came away with asking that is not addressed in the film, is not answered, and is certainly fodder for future discussion and for future movies, is the piece that's missing in these children's lives that allows children of as young as 10 or 11 years old to think that suicide is the only way out of this.
Wow.
And the piece to me that's missing, because many of us endured childhood. Many of us endured bullying,
yeah,
and persecution. I recall, and in talking to many people, they had similar feelings that as dark as childhood became, there was always the one part, the one voice that was, boy, I can't fucking wait till I grow up.
Yeah, and get out of this town.
And get out of here.
Yeah,
get away from this. You
right.
know, yeah, it's miserable, but the awareness that as horrible as it feels, it is short-lived.
Yeah.
And I am going to go and get to make my own life later.
Right.
How is that now missing? What has happened that's missing to an almost epidemic degree where kids are checking out for good, are killing? They cannot envision the possibility of a future beyond this. And all I can think is that somehow it's something that's missing outside of school, something that's missing from home,
that
from
you're
their
not
parents.
Given that this, aspiration,
this
that idea
of that,
or imagination. Does it take imagination?
The capability to imagine a future that is worth living for,
right?
And that's that outside. Seems to be missing.
That you think that this is the pattern that's going to exist for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
and it does
that.
Get,
this is the rest of your life.
Right.
Yeah, that it does not change. That it does not get better.
Well, yeah, and is that fed in popular culture? I'm not even sure.
I don't know, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not following that enough, but I'm going to...
So that's an interesting...
Interesting thought.
For future discussion.
I'm saying that's... I'm going to think
You know, and
that
was always the thing with Roddenberry, you know, and with Star Trek, you know, the idea of a utopian future. And the utopian future is not one without conflict. The utopian future is one where mankind continues to struggle and wrestle with all the same
ideas,
aspects of
things.
its makeup, and yet it is a future worth living for.
Right, that there are things that are corrected.
So, speaking of Star Trek, I saw what I like to call Kirk 2.0 versus Picard's clone.
No.
This means war. Also starring Reese Witherspoon, Christopher Pine,
yeah,
most famous for playing Captain Kirk,
yep,
in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, and Tom Hardy, who, of course, played Picard's clone way back in Star Trek Nemesis. Spoiler alert.
Yes. Way
and
to go.
It was interesting for me because I do enjoy the Chris Pine. He's charming. He's every bit the movie star.
Yep.
I have a personal fondness for Tom Hardy from having known him. Also, truly admire the man's skill and craft.
Yeah.
He is every bit the consummate actor. And so it was very interesting to see, as best friends and rivals, a movie star and a movie actor.
Ah, fascinating.
It reminded me to a degree of Dustin Hoffman with Steve McQueen in Papillon, or Redford in All the President's Men.
Yep.
You know, it is really an interesting pairing of the actor and the movie star.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie, you know, isn't good, and it doesn't really work. But those are interesting from kind of an acting standpoint. Those are interesting.
Is it funny, or is it just
there action? Are some funny moments, and interestingly enough, I thought the biggest laughs, for me anyway, came through Tom's performance.
Ah.
And you don't think of Tom as doing comedy.
No.
But he's working really hard to find authenticity.
Ah.
So the laughs are suddenly real.
That's
and,
where you get
and
it.
And therefore truly funny.
Huh.
Chris's charm is rather effortless. And
right.
It, and it... it does keep you amused.
I am amused by this.
So much to talk about. We have like 12 minutes left.
How are we going
to
do this?
And how are we going to get through this? I don't think we've yet to talk about. No, we can't pick. We owe it to people because this is our last show for 3 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm watching Torchwood. I'm finally watching Torchwood. We never talk about this.
Yes, I know.
Torchwood was one of your favorites.
One of my favorites years ago when it was on BBC America.
And I'm almost done with season one. I've watched 12 episodes now.
Yep.
And I enjoy it to the point that I keep watching it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the shot on video is kind of cute.
Yeah.
The quality of the acting, you know, where I keep going back and forth wondering, is John Barrowman,
yeah,
really bad? And again, I have a past relationship working with him.
Yeah.
Is he really bad or is he so bad he's good? I mean, I don't know.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the weakness, if we can call it that, of the first season is sort of the uncomfortable tonal shifts that take place.
Yeah, they're finding their feet, if you see.
And from what I've read, they really find it by season two.
Season two, it really comes together.
But that weakness is also one of the things that I find myself feeling affection towards.
You're charmed
because
by them.
They're trying.
Yes.
They're trying. And it's not like any of their tones don't work. It's that the shifts are somewhat clumsy.
Yes.
You know, rather than, you know, like how Boston Legal, we were constantly amazed how they could shift tones seemingly so effortlessly and so effectively in a way that was just audacious.
Yes.
And that kind of shift is really difficult. And Torchwood is not pulling off the shifts.
Right.
They're able to capture the tone, but not, again, the transition from one tone to another.
True enough.
And what I thought was interesting that you were such a fan of it was the same could be said for the first few episodes of The Lone Gunman.
Ah, that's right.
It needed to find that footing of how to... really
conspiracy and the comedy and the action and all that together. Yeah, that
and was certainly tough. By the second half of the Lone Gunman season,
they
you
found,
had
it.
Found that.
Yeah,
yeah. But so it's interesting that you are drawn to that.
Exactly. That is funny. Hilarious.
How about your Chill Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week?
The Chill Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
Okay.
I had wanted to talk about Vincent Gallo.
Oh, yeah.
Suing the Los Angeles Arts District Business Improvement District.
Right.
But really, I only wanted to talk about it because how does the Los Angeles Arts District Business Improvement District use the word district twice in its name? They should be sued just for that.
Well, it's
if that's not a waste of our taxpayer money.
It's the art district bid. We shorten it to bid in this urban community known as downtown Los Angeles. We have a bid downtown that's very good in terms of street cleaning, in terms of security. This is money put in by all the businesses to form this. It's a private force. Like technically, it's not under public scrutiny. So he's right there that there are these funds that technically come from the taxpayer but go into a private source. So he does have a point in his lawsuit, but at the same time, if the bid seems to be underperforming, there's very little recourse for anyone to do, which is what he's trying to do. I mean, that's the point of his lawsuit.
Anyway, our lawsuit of the week comes from Agent Summer, who brought to my attention that a New Jersey family... has sued their landlord over paranormal activity. Not the movie, over actual paranormal activity taking place, allegedly, in their home. A New Jersey family filed a lawsuit against their landlord claiming that they were forced to bail on their home because of paranormal activity. I almost bailed on my home after seeing the movie Paranormal Activity because I just wanted to live nowhere near a movie theater in case I might have to see something that laughable ever again. Anyway, this takes place in Toms River.
Okay.
Josu Chinchilla and Michelle Callan made it through a week in their Toms River home before bouncing in the middle of the night because, as they put it, spirits were, quote, tugging at their bed sheets.
Okay.
The couple suing their landlord, well-known local orthodontist Dr. Richard Lopez, because their home is haunted. They even want the $2,250 security deposit back.
How much?
$2,250 security deposit.
Okay. So there's two
things. In the three-bedroom house, strange things occurred during the 7 days. They experienced menacing voices whispering, "Let it burn," slamming doors, footsteps coming up from the basement, and they discovered clothes tossed about. Finally, after the bedsheet incident, they officially cut out.
Right.
And Lopez, the landlord, has fired back with his own suit against the couple for breaking their lease.
Well,
and his attorney has said that a decade's worth of tenants have never had issues with ghosts. And he also rather paints an unflattering portrait of Ms. Callan. Anyway, but it should be pointed out two things.
One, ghosts can follow you from place to place.
That's the premise of Paranormal Activity.
I know, right?
Right. So, indeed, maybe he should be suing them.
I say, eh?
The other thing, though, is this is the neighborhood where Amityville Horror was shot and set.
Ah, so clearly there's show busy ghosts. No, here's the thing. You can, these ghost hunter TV shows, they're dying for this sort of thing. And B, there's other ghost practitioners that can get them to cross over.
Oh, my God. I have the greatest idea.
Okay, hit it.
Two great reality show flavors in one.
House Hunters?
Dean Haglund.
Uh-huh.
Phil Lernis.
Yeah.
Judge Judy. A Paranormal Activity court show.
Oh, I love it. So you sue for Paranormal Activity.
You sue over the Paranormal Activity.
And then you have to investigate the Paranormal Activity and then bring it back to Judge Judy, who determines whether there's a case or not.
Right.
Fascinating. I would think that because evidence...
Is she still alive?
She is, yeah. She's doing very well.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can call her.
I'm two things to say before the show closes. So let's quickly remember this week's celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Okay.
For the first time in my life, there will be no Dick Clark.
Oh yeah,
at the ball drop at the Golden Globes.
I mean, well, think about it. He was on American Bandstand when the birth of rock and roll. That was not recently. That's been a long career.
Time. He had a long career. He had an important and an influential career. No time to list all his accomplishments this week.
Right,
82 years old. Mm. He suffered a massive stroke in 2004 when he was 74 years old. And, you know, here's what struck me a little bit as odd. I was kind of struck that he was only 82.
Oh.
82 really is not that old.
No.
And especially when the joke about Dick Clark for most of our lives was that the dude did not age.
That's right.
That somewhere there was a portrait of Dick Clark hung in a closet that looked horrible.
Right.
Because he never aged. From 1950 through the 1980s, he looked the same. He didn't age.
Yes.
And so it almost is shocking at how rapidly his health disintegrated.
Right, because you would assume that he was keeping his health up to keep that youthful appearance.
Right.
Well, I'm shocked. We'll miss him dearly.
Will we? Dick Clark, 82 years old. Finally, I saw something this week at the Yehevi Gallery in Little Armenia, in an alley in between Berendo and Heliotrope. You can check it out on Google Earth, I guess.
Okay.
It was a film presentation at this artist loft workspace,
okay,
the Yehevi Gallery, from a group called the B Media Collective, not to be confused with the B Film Extras.
They're different.
However, the B Film Extras is fronted by John Lawler, who I met when I directed him. He was one of 10 award-winning high school theater students from around the country who had come to Hollywood in the summer of 2002, 10 years ago.
Yes.
And I directed him in a couple of shows over a period of 3 weeks in Hollywood.
Okay.
Another one of those 10 students was a young lady named Amanda Eckerson. Very talented, eccentric, free spirit Amanda Eckerson. Adored her then, adore her now. And she is one of the members of the B Media Collective
in Portland. Ironic.
And I saw their variety show number 5, Occupation.
Fantastic.
And it was a media presentation all about the Occupy movement. And so it was so great to, first time in 10 years I had seen her, and to see her pursuing her own unique voice and pursuing the arts. There was a line in the film that I wanted to close with since we're going away for a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Somebody said, our bodies are our ballots, and we vote with every step we take.
Of course.
And I thought that was so extraordinarily inspiring.
That is inspiring.
Because, again, as things get so, just disagreeable.
Yes.
In the theater. In contemporary society.
Yep.
You know, and you hear so many people talking about what they're against, what they're opposed to.
Right.
I am struck when I hear a phrase like this, I'm reminded that we never remember people based on what they stood against. We remember people based on what they stood for.
Uh-huh.
In what direction were they walking? What right. votes were they casting with every step that they took?
Right.
And this is a theme that in one form or another we've been talking about in a variety of ways. When we talk about money being energetic and that perhaps the currency of the future is truly admiration. It may, in fact, someday replace paper money.
Right.
But in the meantime, the energy that you imbue money could be admiration. If you realize that you put your money towards things you admire, you will change the world around you.
Absolutely.
And certainly your relationship to it. And
right.
also, therefore, you open yourself up to getting money that is truly admiration.
Like my Kickstarter campaign.
That's true.
So check out my Kickstarter campaign for the Shock and Awesome novel.
And continue, that supporting. Would be my wish, for the next 2 weeks until we rejoin you live. Try to take steps in the direction of that which you admire.
Yes.
In the direction of things that you believe in the direction of things that you stand for.
Exactly.
Vote with every step that you take. And I will try to do the same thing.
Oh, while you're over in the UK, have a great time.
Until, we'll be back with a show next week
yes,
that you
course.
Can listen to. ChillPackHollywood.com. Download and stream them. Subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review if you like.
Like us on Facebook.
Please like us.
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Follow us on Twitter.
Yes, I'm at D. Haglin.
I'm Phil Larinus. And write us, ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com.
See you next week.
Belated spoiler alert.